That one was it a week ago. We said we didn't get a chance to email to anyone yet. Hopefully people will find us. But thank you all for coming. I get an easy job tonight, and that is just to sit, relax, and enjoy. We're very appreciative of Rabbi Grari, who has done all the work tonight to prepare. For those who don't know Rabbi Grari well, I'll give a 45-second introduction. He's the director of Bina, which is just literally around the corner on Old Sathid Road. The new building is just near Mizrahi Shul, over the park, closer to the Caltex station, first building. And Bina lectures, Bina provides opportunities for Jewish education, primarily adult Jewish education in Sydney. And Rabbi Grari with other lecturers have a couple hundred people who come through during each week to, I think it's about 40 different classes on a regular weekly basis, plus many other classes like this. So we're very, very appreciative of Rabbi Grari for coming. Rabbi Grari is also a senior educator. He's had many, many years' experience, including before my days, but I can vouch, I've heard from some people. Were you the headmaster or the principal or director or whatever they call of the Shiva Boys High School in its previous era, I guess. And so we're very appreciative. My wife sent me to come, even though my daughter's only 3 years old. She told me, you better figure out what to do. She's already going on to her teenage years. At least she does that to Rifki. I don't think she gets to do that with me. But regarding the floor is yours.
Thank you. Let's see where I'll stand. Big thank you to Avi and Bev for the house. Thank you to Yossi and Rifki. It's wonderful to do an event together with GEMS, an incredible organization growing at a fast pace. So today we're talking about teenagers. Life is a journey. I read once a story of a family birthday party that was celebrating a grandmother's birthday party. A little five-year-old asked his sister's grandmother, "Tell me, Granny, how old are you?" So Granny says, I'm 62, and the little kid is somewhat sort of stunned, and after a bit of a moment of silence, he turns to her and he says, "Did you start from one?" So we do start from one. We have children who are younger than one, and they grow, and they progress slowly, and they get slowly into their teenage years. Now, someone asked me before what the definition of a teenager is. I'm not sure, because today everything happens quicker than they used to happen, so some people start at six, I don't know, 6, 7, 10... I think we're talking about the attitude of teenage years more than anything else. I'm not sure when it begins, I'm not sure when it ends. I had a whole discussion tonight with I'm now parenting my fifth teenager. Got one more to go. Everyone's different. I used to think I'd be experienced by the fifth one, but everyone's completely unique and different. So you learn new things each time round. But my one teenager was just sort of going out of teenagehood. By the way, was very upset with me because I don't know how, but somehow she's friends with Rifki on Facebook, and saw the ad for tonight's lecture, and she wants to know how, but I have the chutzpah to call it, "What happened to my angel?" She says, "What do you mean? I'm not here." Yeah. No, but it was a nice, friendly discussion. And we were having a discussion about whether she's still a teenager now, and she's 18, learning in Melbourne, here for Pesach. So the definition of a teenager is somewhat complicated. I once read that the definition of a teenager is a girl who goes to a clothing store and returns a clothing of ironing and says to the salesperson, "I'd like to return this because my mother likes it." On a more serious note, teenage years is difficult. Now, what I'm going to say tonight is obviously it doesn't apply to every teenager, to every child. Every child is unique, every child is individual, every person is individual. But we're talking about, we're using generalizations, and teenage years can be very, very difficult. Difficult, by the way, for both. Difficult for the teenager. We don't always realize that, but actually it is very difficult for the teenager, and difficult for the parent. Difficult for the teenager because teenage years is really the years of transition. By design, by divine design, children are born very dependent. We're able to shower them love. They are born completely dependent on us, different to other animals, by the way. Other animals are born, they walk right away. Our children don't. We've got to teach them everything. They are very attached to us, very dependent on us. They're very in their own world. They're not even aware about what's going on around them necessarily in their very, very infant years. And then they need to somehow graduate eventually into adult years. And there's a period in the middle called teenage where we're not sure if they're children, they're adults, they're mini children, they're mini adults. In fact, a few years ago I gave a talk on teenagers. The night before I asked one of my teenagers, I said, tomorrow I'm giving a talk on teenagers. What do you think I should say? So she says, tell them that we're not stupid. I thought it was pretty insightful. Like because we're not sure sometimes we treat them like children, treat them like adults. we confuse, they confuse. There's a Jewish concept, a Kabbalistic concept actually, that talks about a principle, yesh v'yesh v'ayin v'emsa, which means that when you transition from one thing into the next, there's always a very, very tense and nothingness period in the middle. For example, a seed, if you take a pip and you plant it in a tree, you plant it in the earth, before it can actually become a tree, transition into something completely different, it actually decomposes and becomes nothing and then grows into a tree, right? So teenage years are those years of transition where a child that is leaving childhood, discovering independence, discovering their own identity, discovering and becoming more conscious and aware of that which is going on around them. And it's a very, very difficult period. They're confused often. They're not sure about their own identity. Their self-esteem often takes a very big hit, particularly in the teenage years. They don't let you know that. They come across very obnoxious and overconfident a lot of times. But the truth is that it's not really true. The truth is that they're self-esteem takes a very big hit sometimes in the teenage years, and it's a very difficult period for the child themselves as well. But at the same time, of course, it's very difficult for us as parents as well. Part of the reason it's difficult, by the way, is because, see, children, little children, for the most part, think that their parents are absolute God, right? Think they're perfect. There's no one stronger like their parents, no one more beautiful like their parents, and no one more clever like their parents are cleverest, they're the smartest, everything, right? So we're kind of on this, you know, on this huge pedestal with our little kids. And suddenly one day, we wake up in the morning and we're being dethroned. You know, like, we're completely, like suddenly you're nuts, you're stupid, you're an embarrassment. Everyone else's mother is better, everyone else's father lets them do this. I mean, who are you anyway? Why are you interfering? What do you know about life? You know, like they say that the guy who was 23 turned around to his parents and said, oh gosh, it's absolutely amazing how much you've learned in the last 4 years. I used to think you absolutely know nothing, and now you've learned so much. Anyway, so we've come. It happens sort of very, very suddenly. You know, you wake up one morning and there's like an alien in your house. You know, like this, your child has sort of gone and it's been replaced by this alien from Mars or something. They don't even know what to do with it. They don't know. And it's just it can be very, very frustrating, and it can be very debilitating. You know, often we beat ourselves up. By the way, and that's one of the things I want to get across. I'll probably say it a few times tonight. Don't beat yourself up as parents. That's the worst thing parents can do to themselves. We all try our best. Right? We all try our best. We're all going to get there, hopefully, one way or another. We need to keep learning. We need to come to discussions like this. We need to keep thinking and reflecting on parenthood. And parenthood, parenting for all ages, needs constant reflection. But we should never beat ourselves up. We're human. We make mistakes. We'll continue to make mistakes. We'll bounce back. We'll try our best. And we'll also pray a little bit. Praying a little bit is a good thing to do as well. And God will help us out as well. Now, the good news is that we can survive. We can. You need to trust yourself that you can, right? In fact, not only we can survive, but if we think about it, teenage years can actually be an opportunity. It can actually be an opportunity to forge a relationship with children in a way that's deeper than you can do when they're little children, and certainly deeper than you can do when they leave teenager. It's a very, very special time. If we do it right, and if we do the right things, and if we try our best and put in the effort and invest the time, we can actually forge a very, very deep relationship with our teenagers, and even those who are particularly difficult. But we need to know a couple of things, first of all, as an introduction. First of all, we need to know that the stuff that we go through in teenage years, both the children and ourselves, it's normal, okay? If you're, you know, parents... I mean, this is true, I suppose, about all parenting, not only teenagers, but for teenagers particularly. We often think we're alone. We often think we must be the worst parent on the planet, because obviously everyone else is doing a better job than me, so therefore, what's wrong with me, right? And there's nothing wrong with me or nothing wrong with you. It's normal. Parenting is normal. Parenting challenges are normal. Teenage challenges are normal. It's all normal. And we need to accept that fact, and we need to accept their role and our role. We need to accept that teenagers have their difficulties, and I'm trying to understand them, and we're going to talk about that a little bit more. And we also need to acknowledge what our role is. In other words, our role is that although it's normal, the stuff that goes on, although the attitude that we get from teenagers is normal, although sometimes the obnoxiousness we get and the, and, and the comments we get and the criticism we get and the explosions we get from teenagers are absolutely normal. But nevertheless, we have a role. We have to accept our role. Our role is to guide. Our role is to guide and to instruct and to try and be there as the best support as we possibly can in the most effective way that we can be. And we're going to talk a little bit about that, of course. But we shouldn't just give in. In other words, we need to understand that whatever challenges we have is absolutely normal, but the response is not just to give in. And part of the problem that happens today is that people just give in. They say, it's too hard, cannot get them to do what I need them to do, cannot guide them anymore, I've lost them, I can't. We are there, we can do it, we are in charge. By the way, this is something that parents always need to remind themselves every so often. I am actually the guy in charge here. We are the people in charge, we run this house. And like I said, I used to say to my one teenage daughter particularly quite often, I'd say, as long as you don't pay rent yet, I'm in charge. Okay? When you start paying rent, then it's a different story, but sometimes you do things like in a humorous way, it has better effect. So, and she got used to that line, you know, when you pay rent, then we'll talk about it, but until then, I'm actually in charge. However, it needs to be done cleverly, but we need to know that we are in control and we are in charge, and our role is to be there, is to be parents. Now, how do we do that? So what I want to do is I want to talk for a little bit, and I'm not going to talk for that long. I mean, I'll cover a few very important things because I want to leave time for discussion. So I need a few brave people who will be committed afterwards to ask some questions. And of course, the question's about someone else's teenager, not yours, I understand that. Right? But what I want to do is like this. I'm going to base what I'm going to share with you on three things. I'm going to base it, first of all, on the works of Rabbi Daniel Schomburger, who... I've forgotten the title of the book now, but he wrote a book. He's a rabbi in America, a psychologist, and he deals with teens at risk. He wrote a very, very good book about the relationship that we have with our teenagers. I'm going to draw a little bit of experience. As I said, I'm on my fifth teenager now, one more to go. And I also want to give credit to Renee Mills, who is a psychologist who lives here in Sydney, who some of the strategies I'm going to share with you actually comes from her. So, Rabbi Schomburg writes about what he calls the relationship theory. And he talks about, and this is a very, very overlooked concept in teenaging, in parenting teenagers. He talks about the critical importance of developing a relationship with our teenagers. And we'll talk about that in a couple of minutes. Because sometimes we overlook it and we're so busy parenting, or trying to parent, that we don't invest the time to develop that relationship with our teenagers. And as I said before, teenage years are actually an opportunity to develop a very strong relationship with our children. Now, when I talk about developing a relationship, and this is very important, I don't mean becoming our children's friend. We are not our children's friend. We are the parents. Now, some of you who have heard me before will know that I often talk that, and I draw on Jewish sources, of course, and in Jewish literature, there's two types of relationships. There's what we call vertical relationships and horizontal relationships. What I mean by that is there's horizontal relationships where there's equals, so spouses, friends, siblings, right? Where every relationship, of course, is based on respect, but there's a different type of respect. So we're more, what we call in Yiddish, we're more hamish with people who are equals, right? We're more open, we're more comfortable, and so on. But then there's vertical relationships. And vertical relationships means that there's a hierarchy. There's someone older, there's someone younger, there's someone more senior, someone less senior. And parenting is one of the relationships, and that includes teenagers. In the Torah, for example, the mitzvah of kibud av va'em, the mitzvah of honoring parents, is incredibly strict. If you look in the code of Jewish law and you explore, you research the specifics of how Jewish law dictates the context of how the mitzvah of honoring parents, which continues on to adulthood with older parents, etc., of what that includes and what that entails, it's unbelievably strict. Teachers and students are not friends. There's a hierarchy, there's a respect, there's a certain structure that needs to take place. We are not our children's friend. I remember, you know, I studied in yeshiva in New York, in New Jersey and New York. I grew up in South Africa, but I studied overseas. That's why my accent's a bit of a cholent. It's all over the place. Excuse me for that. So I remember when I came here and I went to university. I finished my Master of Education here in Sydney. And the first time I went to a course of lectures, and there was a woman whose name was Loretta Giocelli. She's a professor on learning difficulties. A brilliant, an absolute genius of a woman. And amazing, amazing lecturer. And I was sitting in her class, and people who knew her from before, I didn't know yet, I got to know her later properly. were calling her by her first name, and I was completely shocked. And I realized that's the culture nowadays, right? In yeshiva, we never do that. Our rabbis, we learned in yeshiva, it was always rabbi this and rabbi that, because there's a structure, there's a hierarchy. Okay, so that's the culture, and if that's what happens in a college campus, that's fine. But in terms of how we parent our children, it's important that we realize our position. We need to build a relationship with our children, a very deep relationship with our children, a respectful relationship with our children, but we're not our children's friend. We don't need our children to like us necessarily. I mean, they will eventually if we do it right. We're not on a popularity contest. We are parents, and we have a role as parents. We have to always remember that. So we have to develop a relationship, but as a parent. Now, let me therefore develop that, and base it on what Daniel Schomburg refers to as the three C's. Okay. The three C's are connection, control, and communication. I'm using this formula, and I'm going to extrapolate a bit because it's a great formula, and it's just a great formula to walk away and remember. Those three things, those three C's: connection, control, and communication. So let's talk about connection. As we've just said, we need to use the teenage years as parents to develop this bond with our teenage children. That's more important than anything. Now, we need to understand that it's very difficult, and it's very difficult sometimes for many, many reasons. It's very difficult because we spend our parenting of teenagers' time so busy with balancing the rules and navigating the complex course of parenting them and trying to, you know, manage their moods and their explosions and so on, that we manage their behavior and we overlook the necessity to invest time to develop that bond. The second reason that it's very difficult is that it's very difficult to have a relationship with someone that's completely unpredictable. Right? And teenagers, for the most part, are very unpredictable. They're a bit like the stock market. One day it booms, the next day it crashes. Or perhaps more particularly, it's a bit like the Melbourne weather, like in 1 hour. You know? 1 minute it shines, the next minute, what happened? Like, what did I say? Did anything happen? Like, you know. So it is very difficult. It's very difficult to have a relationship, a healthy relationship, with someone that you don't know where you stand with them, right? I mean, you wouldn't have a friend like that, because people have friends like that and normally give them up, because who wants to have a friend with someone who's completely inconsistent, completely unpredictable? But you don't get to choose your teenager. That's who it is. So therefore, you have to build that relationship, notwithstanding that they are completely, completely unpredictable. And because of that, teenagers actually tend, a lot of them, not all of them, but a lot of them tend to make themselves very unlovable. I don't know if you noticed, but I mean, some of them just make them like not that easy to love, you know what I'm saying? We also have our own self-esteem issues. Don't forget, you know, we are also human beings. You know, we don't like to be, you know, it's very difficult. It's very different. Like, I think in the last set of lectures that we did, we talked about anger management. And we talked about one of the strategies about not personalizing issues. Now, it's very easy not to personalize, you know, when your five-year-old is disrespectful, your five-year-old screams at you or does something or pushes your buttons. Because, you know, at the end of the day, you rationalize it. It's a five-year-old, didn't mean it, that kind of thing. But when a 16-year-old turns around and says, I hate you, or you're the worst mother that exists on the planet for I don't know how many centuries, or you don't know how to cook, or you don't know how to do this, or you don't know how to do that, we tend to personalize. It's very hard not to become insulted. It's not very hard not to personalize it and not to carry it over kind of to the next day, right? It's also very hard to invest in something where you don't get results very soon. See, friendships are different. Every relationship that exists needs investment. Relationships don't develop on their own. Nothing. No relationship. Not marriage, not friendships, not siblings, not parents. Right? Adult parents, adult children and parents, nothing is nurtured without work. But most relationships, when you put in the work, you see results fairly soon. And particularly in our day and age, we kind of need almost instantaneous results. Now with teenagers, this is an important thing to remember, with teenagers we don't get instant results. Because part of, and this is so important, always have in the forefront of our mind, part of navigating the years of teenagehood successfully is to provide the anchor for our children when they finish that difficult period. All right, that's very important to understand. You might not see the results right away. You develop that relationship with them, but they will continue to fight it until they've discovered themselves. Even if you do it successfully, you won't get that feeling, you know. Some people like to say, I'm so close with my 15-year-old. Maybe some parents are, but you don't need to be that close with your 15-year-old. You need to have a very good relationship with the 15-year-old. You need to have a very deep bond with them. But you don't have to have that close, loving friendship. Because sometimes they will continue to fight it, because the purpose of successful parenting of teenagers is that the research shows that the most powerful factor in a person's life is the home. You know? More than friends, more than school. The most powerful influence on a person's life is their home. The stability of the home, the happiness of the home, the success of the parenting, the effectiveness of the parenting, and also a little bit of pressure. But that's the reality. And at the end of the day, we find very often that children, even who drift and go off course and go kind of off the path that we want them to go, often they'll return and they'll reconnect to their home values, because the home is an anchor. And the better we do the teenaging years, the stronger the anchor we provide for those children to reconnect to and to base themselves on when they become adults and when they become parents. So it's hard to build a relationship with them, because you might not get the results immediately, but the results come eventually. So it's difficult. So here are two critical rules. Here are two critical things to bear in mind when we talk about the C of connection. The first thing to bear in mind is that although it's difficult, but every teenager needs love. Every teenager needs attention, even when they tell you they don't want it. Every teenager needs the relationship. Now, to develop that, and if you can remember nothing else besides this, and I had one very difficult teenager that I used to remind, this book kind of saved me a bit, because it was difficult, and I reflected upon this again and again and again. The teenager that makes it the most difficult to have a relationship with is the one that needs it the most. Right? If you remember nothing else, remember that one. The teenager that makes it impossible to love is the one that is craving your love, is the one that is crying out for your relationship. And you need to do everything possible, as difficult and as unlovable as they have become, they're the ones that need it the absolutely most. And how do you do it? You do it like this. You do it, number one, by developing a very thick skin. No, we do it by developing a very strong ability to forget. What do I mean? I mean, there can be many scenarios, but take the following. All right? You've got a teenager, and you've got a couple of little kids, and everything's sort of calm. Have you ever had a situation where everything's sort of calm and in walks the teenager? Right? Some teenagers have like a real presence, right? So you have two little kids, they're playing, they're minding their own business, you're preparing supper, you're sitting in the study, you're doing something, you're reading, whatever. Things are calm, someone's watching TV, I don't know, whatever's happening in the house, and suddenly in walks the teenager, boom! You know, walks into the room, trips over one of the younger siblings, creates a commotion, is in a bad mood for something, who knows why, and it's Sunday night, and what's for supper? Leftovers? What, you forgot how to cook? Every Sunday night leftovers, and they start... Right? I'm telling you what, only things from experience, right? So, I mean, in our house, we have leftovers Sunday night from Shabbat, right? So, why should we throw it out? So, leftovers, yuck, every Sunday night. My friend's parents, it's always the friend's parents. Right? It's sick here. And you know something? I can't eat this, I hate this, and I'm going to starve, and I'm going to die of hunger. So Jewish mother, of course, gets hunger. By the way, there's scientific research that if someone misses supper, they actually don't die of hunger. By the way, they actually do wake up the next morning. Amazing years of research they've discovered. Right? And then, of course, you get a court of God, and you're like, how dare you talk to me like that? And someone's like, and there's this whole thing, and they push your buttons, and they insult you, and it becomes a thing, and sometimes we don't know how to do it properly, so we don't respond properly, so we end up in this fight, and we're in this shouting match, and it's terrible, and she storms out to her room, slams the door, and then we do the wrong thing, we say, don't slam the door, come back here, terrible thing to do, you should never do that, but, it's like, seriously, you should never do that, and it's just a mess, and you go to bed, like, feeling, what a failure of a parent, man. Okay, next morning, you get up, you get the younger kids up. Of course, teenagers, impossible to wake up. They're going to wake up 3 minutes before you need to leave, and you're honking the horn, and they swing out, kind of thing. Right? Little kids are okay. Next morning, you're in the kitchen, and in walks a teenager 2 minutes before you have to leave. One of two things happen. Either walks in, and she or he's completely forgotten about the night before, you haven't, but just completely forgotten about the night before and says, "Hi, Mum." You think to yourself, "Hi, Mum? Are you serious?" After that explosion and that drama last night, you walk in and you say, "Hi, Mum." Like, where's the apology? I'm not talking to you for the next 3 days. You know what I mean? Kind of, "Hi, Mum." Or they don't. You know, a lot of teenagers actually can't say "Hi, Mum" in the morning because it takes them 3 hours to, like, get out of a comatose state to, like, you know, to be, like, sort of actually functional. So they walk in 2 minutes before you have to leave, and just without batting an eyelid, like, "Where's my lunch?" Those kind of things. And you think to yourself, "Ah, this is crazy. I'm not going to, like..." We need to develop that ability to completely forget about it. That when they walk down that stairs in the morning and they come into the kitchen, you smile at them, give them a hug, if they're in the mood of a hug, right? You need to always gauge whether they're in the mood of a hug or not. They might not be. Or give them a virtual hug, or a, you know, a symbolic hug. Say something nice. Ask them what they have on today. Rebuild that relationship right away. Now, that doesn't mean, I'm not suggesting you condone the behavior of the night before. If the night before's behavior was terrible, then it was terrible and needs to be dealt with, but it needs to be dealt with separately. Right? We need to learn the ability, particularly with difficult teenagers, of not carrying over stuff till the next day.
When do you deal with that?
You deal with it? Okay, I'm going to get to that, because that's a really important question. I'm going to get to it in the next one. But there is a time to deal with it, and there's a way to deal with it, but not at the expense of building a relationship. In other words, what they did was bad. They are not bad. They are your child, and your child needs to be accepted and loved unconditionally, even when they are a terror, right? Even when they're terrible. So therefore, they walk down, you have to still be nice to them, still say nice to them, still have to take them out, still do things with them, still joke with them, still love them. Whatever way you can show love, you need to do, notwithstanding that there's a lot of unfinished stuff. We need to stand higher as parents. We need to develop that ability of not damaging relationship. We have to be committed to the end, to building a relationship with this child, to preserving the relationship with this child, and to keep having that relationship. That is the first C that is so important. And part of how that happens as well is through investing time. Now, many of you have heard me before, will know that one of the things that all relationships lack today the most is time. And time means, because it's a very, very fast moving world, we spend a lot of time schlepping and extra lessons and who knows what, and all kinds of wonderful, important things, and we don't spend enough. This isn't only teenagers, by the way, this is everyone. This is spouses, this is little children, everything, but particularly with teenagers, we need to spend time with them. Spend time doesn't mean spend time doing homework or instructing or guiding or commanding. Spend time means spend time having fun, schmoozing. Now, with teenagers, it's difficult because you need to know if they're in the mood, you need to know what time they want to spend. They might want to go shopping with you. They might not want to go shopping with you. They might want to do stuff with you. They might want to, you know, I don't know if you have this, for example, if you take family outings. I mean, when I had a couple of small kids, it was beautiful. Every Sunday we'd go out, take the kids to a park. It was wonderful. As soon as one became a teenager, it became a whole complicated thing. What, you're going to the park? The park is boring, you know, right? Boring. One of the favorite words of teenagers, boring, right? So then you need to know, you want to come, you don't want to come, like all that kind of stuff, but we need to find ways. Finding out what they're interested in, understand their will. They might have a hobby they like to do that maybe you can do with them, you can help them with. Fathers and sons, maybe sometimes, you know, they might want, I don't know, build things. Whatever. Every child is different. They might be into IT. And maybe, if you're lucky, you get a father who also knows something about IT. Not always, but right, that kind of thing. You need to find ways of spending time with them, dealing with the stuff, separating the bad stuff from the person, finding ways to spend time with them, building that relationship, and dealing with the stuff we have to deal with separately, not carrying over the negative. Often, what kids do is they test us, we clash, and then we dig our heels in and we keep clashing because we're going to win. Let's not win. Let's choose to be, as I always say, let's choose to be happy rather than right. And let's build that relationship with our children.
My question is, when you do find that opportunity, the phone comes with them, and then you've lost them. So even if it's a simple thing like buying a new bra, it's a necessity, you have to do it, you go, and then all of a sudden they're like showing their friends and which one is.
Okay, that's a huge problem.
You know, we've got a thing, on Friday night, no mobile phones, that's it. And we're not strong, we're not religious, we, you know, we just, whatever, but that is our rule. That is our finite rule.
So what you would do is... So what you would do is, okay, you want to do that shopping, let's go together and I'll buy it for you, right? So you get into the car. Now what you do, planning, by the way, is always a great thing in all parenting situations. So that's a great, and that's, by the way, a huge problem today, right? I mean, I go berserk when I'm talking to my teenage daughter and explain anything. So, I mean, I don't show that I'm berserk, but I am going berserk. It's shocking. But planning is always good, and you negotiate. So you say, okay, you want to, I'm going to take you, I'm going to go with you to the store and buy with you. So, I know you're taking your mobile phone with you, but listen, I don't mind taking you, and I love this spending time with you. So we're going to make a deal, right? Okay, until we get to the store, no mobile phone, put it away. First 5 minutes of the store, no mobile phone. After that, you can take it out and show your friends. So at least you get some time, and you haven't given up completely on mobile phone. So you negotiate. But it's much better, and it's always, I mean, I was going to get to it a little bit further, but this is a critical thing. It's always best to plan and to deal with stuff outside of the situation. The worst thing you can do is when they've already taken out the mobile phone and you say, please put that away. Then it becomes a struggle.
I'm really screaming that in one of the shops lines.
Yeah, and okay.
And she even said to me, she's embarrassing me. And I was like, I had lost it completely.
Yeah, we're going to talk about embarrassment in a second. But yeah, so wait a couple minutes and I'm going to get to that about how to deal with it on the situation, right? But as a rule, never deal with it when it's happening.
No. Because I've learned that now.
Even with little children doesn't work, but particularly with teenagers. Mm-hmm. Yeah? So that's the first C. And I wanted to emphasize it because if we take nothing else away, that's so critical. Do whatever it takes to preserve and to deepen the relationship you have with the children. Don't damage it at any cost. Because once you lose the relationship, you lost them. And that has far-reaching damaging effect. The second is control. And what we mean by the second C, control, is that we have to learn when teenagers become teenagers to give up control. And that can be very difficult as parents. And what that means is as follows. When we are parents of teenagers, we are still their guide, but we need to accept that molding is over. Now, you don't mold a teenager. You guide them, you can lay down certain rules, but you won't mold them. Molding is finished for the time they're a teenager. Right? And therefore, as parents of teenagers, to five-year-olds and to little children, we communicate rules. And that's fine, and we should, because there's boundaries and there's rules, and we need to learn how to communicate rules effectively, and that's a separate discussion, even to five-year-olds. But to teenagers, we cannot communicate rules, particularly nowadays. Right? See, you need to understand that nowadays the whole concept of authority is almost out the window. You ever watched Question Time in Parliament House? No, seriously, it always sickens me. It's very fun. I think it's funny to do. Fantastic to watch. It's entertaining. I just watched a clip the other day of Tony Abbott and Julie Gill having a go at each other. I mean, it was unbelievable, right? But you know what kind of terrible message that sends? You know what kind of... Like, these are the people supposed to be leading the country. These are the guys in charge. And they can talk to each other like that. So what do you want from your kids, right? So the whole concept of authority is almost out the window. Particularly when people are dealing with teenage stuff. Rules, they don't like rules. They're testing rules. They don't like those kind of boundaries. So as parents of teenagers, we actually cannot communicate rules. What we could do is, and this is a fundamental difference, is we can communicate values. Right? And the difference between a value and a rule is this. A rule is something that I like a particular thing to happen in a particular way. It might be important to me, it might not be important to someone else. It might actually not even be important. It's just the way I like it done. Values are different. Values are the things that are very dear to me, and everyone needs to work out what their values are. In Judaism, of course, it's easy in a way because we have the Torah. The Torah prescribes certain values and fundamental morals and values. So therefore, values are things which are very, very important to me, and the people who live in my house, I guide them in my position as their guide and as their parent. I expect those people to live by those values. Now, I can't dictate the values you're going to live by when you become 25 and move out of home, but I can... expect that those values are here to when you're in the house, when you're not paying rent yet, right? So therefore, if you want to give an instruction to a teenager, the first thing you need to do is question yourself. You need to really pick your battles. If it's just a rule, forget it. Give up control. You need to question yourself, is this really important to me? Is this really a value that is that important to me? And is it a value that I live by as well, that I'm expecting my teenage to live by as well. Right? I know that's a cliche, you've got to set by example, but it's incredibly important. Another favorite word of teenagers is hypocrite. Right? They're very sensitive.
You're a hypocrite.
They can't stand that. I mean, I heard from a therapist that once sitting in the therapy session, this is not a true story. She was sitting in the therapy session with a mother and a daughter, and the mother was complaining, obviously the kid is out of control, and therefore that got to the level they either got therapy, and the mother complains that the 12-year-old daughter has a filthy mouth and is swearing a lot, and the parent didn't think it was right. So the therapist turns to the mother and says, "I'll ask you a question, do you swear?" And the mother said no, to which the daughter of course says, "Rubbish, of course you do." And the mother says, "No, only in the car." Sorry. Right. So if we ask a teenager to do something, we've got to really, I mean, you know, those days are gone where we can expect people to do things we say but not what we do. That doesn't work, right? So we need to really question ourselves. Is this something I value? Is it really, really important to me? Is it a real value for me? And do I live by that value? If it's not, if it's just a rule, forget it. And let me give you an example. You know that 95% of teenagers do not fold their laundry and do not keep a tidy room. I don't know this. Which is strange because 50% of the population do, meaning adults. Right? I don't know the exact percentage, but most people keep a tidy environment. Some don't, but most people do, right? Most teenagers don't. Okay? So I want sort of a great strategy. If you want your teenager to keep their room tidy, what you should do is this. You should tidy it up, go in and tidy it up once, like really the way you like it, the way you want it. Take a picture of it. Blow up the picture. Put it on the door and then close the door. And every time you walk by, you will see a tidy room. Seriously, I cannot understand the battles that parents have with their teenagers looking at their room. It is ridiculous. It is a stupid battle to have. Because who cares? If they're happy, it's very different to come make a mess here. Now, one second. Make a mess here, you can't. I'm sorry, that impinges on my living. So in my study, my dining room, my kitchen, you don't make a mess. And if you make a mess, clean up yourself. And that's, I insist on that, because that's also a value. It's courtesy for other people, to respect other people. You're in your own room, you want to live in a pigsty, go right ahead. As long as you don't leave food that decomposes, you know what I'm saying? What the?
Wet towels?
I don't know. If it turns into mold, it becomes a problem. Otherwise, you know what I'm saying? Like, seriously, I mean, you can encourage once in a while, but to have a fight over it? Just not worth it. That's just one little example, right? Like the types of things that, you know, we go crazy over the nutrition, over this, you know, over the way they eat, the speed that they eat in, all this kind of stuff. It's not worth the fight. Seriously, it's not worth the fight, right? I mean, I think insisting on a couple of family meals without iPhones is a great idea, but otherwise, you know, let go. We need to let go of control. So we need to understand what are the things that are really important values for us, and the rest, let go, let go. Now, if something is a real value, right, and it's something we really do insist on, so let's take your example. You want to have a meal without mobile phones, then you have to go for it all the way. If it's important to you, but it's a value, which I think this is a great value, right, then it has to be an absolute rule. And the way to do it is, remember you are in control, you are in charge, and you have to communicate that rule with absolute firmness and assertiveness without being scared. In our house, in this meal, there are no mobile phones. That's it, right? Now, state the value. State it strong with a voice of authority and go for it all the way and be prepared to go for it all the way. To insist. I don't mean screaming and shouting. I mean insist in it all the way. What happens if they don't listen? So here comes an important thing. First of all, consequences with teenagers are not very effective. What are you going to say? Anyone gives consequences to teenagers? What's a good punishment for a teenager?
No, I just think where they mobile phone for a day or two.
Okay, so that could work.
They can't
no, as they get older, they will get another mobile phone somehow. They're very smart.
No.
Yeah. Look, natural consequences work. For example, you know, you can watch TV for a certain amount of time, or you could be on Facebook for a certain amount of time. After that, I disconnect the whole internet from that, so whatever the case is, or we unplug it. Natural consequences could work, but you've got to be very careful. You know, I need you home by 10:30. That's a value. Safety of children is a value. Their social group is a value. Those things can be very, very important. And you should know where your teenagers are all the time, and you should monitor it, and you should, from the background, monitor their social structure. right? But you say to the child, you've got to be back by 10:30 or 11 o'clock tonight, or else I'm going to ground you for 2 weeks. You know, they get older, if they're very firm, they'll jump out the window. Or they just won't bother coming home next time. Or, I mean, there's all kinds of things that can happen. You've got to really, really minimize the consequences. They're not very effective, and they also damage the relationship. What you could do is, the child comes home late, you sit them down the next day and say, you know, I was really disappointed. The rule in this house is you've got to be home at 10:30. So you become the broken record. You state the rule again. You communicate the value again. You repeat it, and it comes across very, very firm. And eventually they do get it. Right? If you've also invested in the first C. See, the first C supports the second C. You have a good relationship with them. They do get it. They are bothered when you're disappointed. They won't show you. They'll fight it. But they actually are bothered when you show that you're really disappointed. That they've broken the rule. That is so important to you and to the house structure.
But there have to be consequences, though.
There have to be little consequences.
There has
but you
to
have
be some sort of punishment. It doesn't need to be a severe punishment, but there has to be something.
Yeah, but
what
some,
can you do? What
but
you
sometimes, do? So you've got to be very... No, I agree with you. But sometimes it's really a matter of showing your disappointment that it can be even as good as a punishment. I'm just saying, a lot of consequences don't work. A lot of consequences, all they actually end up doing is breaking the relationship. Because, you know, you threaten with a consequence, first of all, you've got to be ready to follow through. And sometimes that's very difficult. You know, when even little children, you come with a consequence, you've got to be really, you've got to think it through. Am I able actually to really follow through with this, you know? Is it that practical? That kind of thing, right? It's like with little children, they go to a restaurant with a six-year-old. I'm not sure why people do this, but they do sometimes. And, you know, you say, if you don't sit down at the table nicely, which isn't a reasonable expectation anyway, but, you know, I'm going to take you home. If you don't sit down, I'm going to take... Are you really going to go home? What, you're going to actually put them in the car and go home? If you are going to do it, that's fine. But if you don't really want to do it because you want to finish the meal at the restaurant with your friends or the rest of the family, then it's not a reasonable thing to say, right? So you've got to be very careful. But the most important thing is to restate the value, restate the firmness and assertiveness your disappointment. But here comes the critical thing. The critical thing is always try never to do it in the heat of the moment. Right? That doesn't work. The child comes home an hour late. Hello? You know, they're coming as if nothing's happened. Hi, Mom. Hi, Dad. You know you're an hour late. Say nothing. Because you know when you say something now, it's going to be a major fight. The next day, and a little bit more reasonable. You catch a moment when they're in a good mood. Could take a couple of days, but catch and say, can we just take a walk for 5 minutes? I just need to talk to you for 5 minutes. Put away the mobile phone, please. You know, the other night you came home late. What was the deal? The deal was 10:30, 11 o'clock. You came home at 12 o'clock. It's not on. And the rule was, I don't mind you going out. I'm very happy with you enjoying yourself with your friends, but a time is a time. But you do it then, it's much more powerful than doing it in the heat of the moment. When they've broken the rule, they already feel guilty, they put on this whole facade, like, hello, as if nothing happened. They know they've broken the rule. You start with them, it becomes a struggle, it doesn't work. You can't always do that. I mean, if they're pounding a little sister, for example, then it's got to be on the spot, because someone's in danger. But if no one's in danger, best thing is don't deal with it then. You're upset, they're upset, both of you need to calm down, catch a moment, and be very assertive. And then it works, yeah.
Grandma, when it comes to your values, okay, so we'll use the mobile phone example. So my daughters know they're not allowed the mobile phones at the Shabbos dinner table. What happens when they go to your house? How do I know that they are sticking by that value even though I'm not there? That's what worries me. Yes, I know there needs to be trust, but as soon as I ask a question or hint or suggest... So when it comes to coming home an hour late, at this stage, I'm in control of that because I'm doing the lifts and who's lifting. So that's okay for now. But
look, I think, you know, sometimes you've got to be smart about these things.
I think
the smart thing to do would be this. If your daughter is going to someone else's house for Friday night dinner, right?
I'm using that as an example.
Okay, let's say an example.
Okay.
I'll say before you go... Have a great time. I want you to remember we have a rule number about funds for our night. I'm going to trust you. You're going to keep to it. I'm not going to ask you afterwards. I'm not even going to investigate it afterwards. And I'm just going to trust you.
I think if you built that relationship initially, I've got two older daughters, and that relationship is really, really good. And I've built that relationship. I'm invested time in that. I think I've always said that I'll trust you. And if I find, if I ever find that trust broken, then there's consequences.
See, my trust has been broken.
But I think even if trust has been broken, I'll say, look, you know, I'm prepared. If it hasn't broken, reminder. But listen, I'm prepared to try again. I'm prepared even to commit to you not to investigate it. Look at our trust. You've got a much better chance of it being kept. See, as soon as they know you're becoming a detective, they'll outsmart you.
Yeah, we had an incident where she went out one night and she broke our trust by, she knows that when she tells us she's going somewhere, she has to ring us if the arrangements has changed. The arrangement changed. They ended up sleeping at someone else's house. And we found out about this the next morning. I got in my car, I drove over to this person's house, didn't know who the person was, knocked on the door. They were all fast asleep. It was her and four of her friends. I said, get up, get dressed. Took them to the car, didn't say a word. Took the kids, their friends home, took her home, didn't say a word. Left her in the room for half a day.
She went straight to her room.
And then, like you said, afterwards we sat down and said, right.
Fantastic. As I was listening to you, I was saying, I hope you didn't scream at her.
She's never done it again.
Yeah, no, but then you're able to do that.
But we punished her. What we did was we took away the computer, the mobile phone, for a week.
Every situation, if you're able to do that, and it was warranted, then by all means. I'm just saying that with consequences, you need to always think about how it's going to work, that's all. But I would say, and I'm sure the consequence has something to do with it, but I would say the fact that you drove there, yanked her home, didn't say anything, just took her home, is probably even more powerful than the consequence. That would be my guess. But I mean, again, something's really consequences, and if it works, it works. But you always have to think it through. But that was very assertive. You see, but don't become a detective. If it's something about, like the other example, like you, that it's hard to find out, I wouldn't even bother.
Well, it was that again.
Yeah, okay, so it comes to your attention.
But you know, all the mothers are failing, and do you know where they are? And I don't know where they are, and no one knew where they were, and...
Sure,
and
very powerful. And then later on, when everything's calm, you do sit down and you say, you know, I love you and I worry, and you just can't do that. We have an agreement, and I'm happy for you to, you know, always put the positive. I'm happy for you to go, etc., but you got to keep it. Okay, you know what? Let's just move on a little bit, and then we'll. You have a question?
No.
Now, another thing also is an important concept. You know, we need to treat teenagers like adults as much as we possibly can.
Can I ask you a question? So,
sure.
In that situation where their daughter didn't do the right thing, can you throw the question at them when you're discussing this in the heat of the moment? Can you tell me what you think you did wrong, what upset us?
Yeah, I mean, again, you need to do what's effective. In other words, as long as it's respectful, and we'll talk about communication in a minute. You can do it any way you want to, as long as it's respectful and it's strong and it's clear. And you make it very, very clear that your love for them is unconditional. Right? And that's part of the conversation also. But I just can't have you do that. Because I love you, I'm worried. And yeah, what do you think? What would you do? But sometimes we need to involve them in the decision. You know, sometimes, for example, teaching teenagers responsibility is a very difficult thing. They don't like to be responsible, as you would have noticed. And they don't like to do household chores and that kind of thing. So sometimes it's good actually to have a bit of a discussion, a family discussion, and sort of, you know, listen, we're all a team here, we're all living in this house, things need to get done. It's Pesach coming up, or Shabbat coming up, whatever the case is, things need to get done, these are the jobs. What are we going to do? You know, one kid will say, well, no, I'm washing dishes is not my thing, well, fine, then do something else then. But let's come to some sort of agreement. The more you can involve them in choosing what they're going to do, the better, making them responsible, and also giving them a lead time, like, okay, you know, like with one of my kids, we say, like, okay, so we have a discussion with her, like, mommy needs you to fold your laundry because the whole laundry room is getting clogged up with your laundry. Once it's in your room, actually, I'm not aware what happens to it, but it actually needs to get away. So, oh, yes, of course, I know I'm going to do it, I say, fine, just tell me when you're going to do it by. Give me a time. Right? So make them choose. Now, I want it done before 10:30. Then they know they'll do it before 10:30 the next morning, right? You know, like the famous story, the guy said, I'm coming before Pesach. He just didn't say which Pesach, right? I did it. Okay, just tell me when you're doing it by. Okay, I'm very busy tonight. My friend, I've got an assignment all of a sudden. I've got a lot of homework all of a sudden. And I can't do it, but I'll get it done by 6 o'clock tomorrow evening. Fine, no problem. Deal? 6 o'clock tomorrow evening, it's done? Great. And then leave it. Don't micromanage. I hate to be micromanaged. They don't like, you know, what was that acronym we stopped? Who told me the acronym before? Parent of Assault, what was it? Yeah, Parent of Assault, yeah, POS, right? It's the new one of the acronyms they use in WhatsApp and all that. So,
it's not so new.
Oh, one of the, yeah, we're all doing it. New as in, we didn't have when I was 10 years old.
If you say, go undo the dishwasher, and they don't do it, but you need to put the rest of the dishes, the dirty dishes, in the clean dishwasher.
No, that's what I'm saying. So
what do you say?
Yeah, but that's routine
say,
stuff.
Wait until...
No, but that's something else. No, so that's different. But then I would have a bit of a discussion with them, and I'd say, listen, you know, every night we have a dishwasher, it needs to be empty, so I can put new stuff there, whatever the case is. Tell me what night you're going to be responsible, or which nights are you going to be responsible for? You know, let's decide, right?
That's every night.
Okay, well, if you want, good. Okay, but I mean...
Not once per week, and my husband drives me absolutely berserk.
But I plan that out. And, you know, also, every child is different, right? I mean, I know, I've got, as I said, I'm a fifth teenager. You know, my wife and I always discuss this, because before Pesach particularly becomes incredibly emphasized. Some are natural helpers, and some just aren't, right? And the ones that aren't, just need to do a little bit just to teach them responsibility. But, you know, don't rely on the ones that aren't, because if they aren't, they aren't. Right? Don't try to play. You know, some people just drive this like, you know.
It's not fair.
It isn't, but...
They never did it. It's not their fair.
Laugh and fair.
No. She did more,
and
this one did less.
I used to have a thing in my house, and every someone said enough fair, saying just enough fair died. And that was the end of it. And I knew it like it was probably a brick wall. It just doesn't register. I never hear it anymore in my house. It's not fair. Because I used to hear it, and I used to say Mr. Not Fair died. And that was it. End of story. Yeah. Listen, no, but look, I'm saying people need to participate. And sometimes things aren't fair, and you need to talk to them. But just some people will help more than others, and you've got to have a reasonable expectation. So yes, you need to teach teenage responsibility, and if they need to empty the dishwasher, but if it's going to be a struggle every single night, I wouldn't do it every single night. I would make them
do it. My whole thing you've got
to
do.
You know, it might be even worth it to save the relationship. I'm not saying it might be worth it. It's easier for me to do it than to have a struggle war every single night. But that doesn't mean I'm going to give up on it. I'll say to them, listen, yeah, I know you don't like doing this, but I'm not going to do it every night. So let's share. I'll do it twice a night, Daddy will do it twice a night, and you do it once. You pick your night.
How do you pick? What do you give them pocket money? Can you expect them to do it?
I don't know how effective it could. I wouldn't link it. I mean, you could have pocket money as a consequence. Yeah. But first establish an effective rule, right? Say, okay, so now you tell me, let's negotiate, tell me what nights you're going to do. Alright, and I'm not going to, and it's going to be done by a certain time, by 10 o'clock at night, or by 9 o'clock at night. I'm not going to stand over your shoulder. I'm trusting it's going to be done. If it's not done, I mean, if you want as a consequence to withhold some pocket money, that'll work. It's you know, it's okay. I mean, they get themselves a job. I mean, something like that. So. Okay, what I want to do is just finish the last C and then take some more questions, because I think the discussion is really good. The last C is really, really important. It's the C of communication. So we've talked about connection. We talked about giving up control. We talked about communication. Communication means a lot of things, and now's not the time to go into the whole discussion on what communication is, but let's just suffice with the following few concepts. Communication really begins with listening. Right? The foundation of good communication is active listening. Teenagers need to feel that they've been heard, which means you don't always have to agree, but you need to hear. Real communication means, communication between human beings means that you understand the world of another person. Well, that's what real communication is. And teenagers have a whole different world than us, a completely different reality, which we had too, by the way, when we were teenagers. But they have a whole different reality, and we need to try and understand. And when they come back, they often don't want advice. They don't want you to tell them off. They don't want to be lectured to. They just want to be listened to. Teenager storms in, it was the worst day of school I've ever seen. Lad, this teacher's absolutely retarded, and this one is this, and that one is that. Just listen. Listen, try to understand, ask questions. Don't even offer advice. They might not even want your advice. You can try and find out if they want advice, but most times teenagers don't want advice from their parents because they don't think the parents know anything. So therefore, it's not... Right? It's truth. Right? I had my 21-year-old son talk to me last year when he was back from overseas. He says, you know, some of the things you did when I was growing up were pretty smart. I said, yeah. But when they're growing up, I don't think it's very smart. So just listen to them. They need to be listened to. That's what communication is. Communication is talking to them, but it's listening to them. It's also talking to them. And one of the critical aspects of communication of any relationship, because it's the basis of any relationship, is even when we have to be firm, and even when we have to be assertive, it has to be with respect. You never scream at a teenager in front of other people, unless if there's danger involved. You never embarrass. By the way, teenagers hate to be embarrassed. People hate to be embarrassed. But I once heard from a top psychologist that teenagers, the definition of a teenager is someone that spends 24 hours a day working out how not to be embarrassed. Right? They hate being embarrassed, and they have this notion in their head that their parents are the biggest embarrassment. So therefore, don't embarrass them. They don't like to be embarrassed. They don't like to be humiliated. Every relationship, the foundation of every relationship is respect. Respect doesn't mean they're equal. Respect doesn't mean we buddy-buddy. There's a superiority. I believe one of my values as a parent, and I include this in teenaging, is that I will not tolerate disrespect. And teenagers do a lot of disrespect a lot of times. Now, I won't deal with it on the spot, as I said before, but I will always deal with it afterwards because I'm not prepared to put up with disrespect, because I believe that one of the fundamental values of a Jewish type of relationship is the concept of respect. It's critical for the rest of their life, and therefore I will not tolerate them talking to me with absolute chutzpah, or using bad language, but you deal with it, as we talked about before, you have to deal with it properly, but I will deal with it. But at the same time, they need to be respected too. They need to be talked to like adults, they need to be talked to with respect. You can be very firm, but screaming doesn't work, humiliating doesn't work, and just being disrespectful to them doesn't work. Calling them names, saying they're stupid, or lazy, or dumb, or all that kind of stuff is terrible. It's a blow to their self-esteem, it destroys their character, and it doesn't work. It damages the relationship that we have with them. In that book I mentioned before from Daniel Schoenberg, he says this, and I put it for you on your handout. He says the Ten Commandments of communication go like this. He says there's five, thou shalt not, and there's five things you should. The things you should never do is insult, judge. I don't like to be judged. You can be firm and clear, but don't judge, blame, insinuate, or embarrass. The things we should do is compliment appropriately. We should, and it's hard to compliment teenagers, by the way, because not in front of other people, and it's got to be appropriate, etc. It's got to be cool, and maybe this, that.
Yeah. Leads to embarrassment.
What's that? Yeah, exactly. So, you know, which it doesn't. We have to accept them, even when
all
they do.
Words lead to embarrassment.
Exactly. Even when they do the wrong thing, we need to learn to accept them. The most important part of maintaining a relationship is to accept them. We try our best to guide, but we will succeed, hopefully. But we need to accept where they are. We need to encourage. We need to empathize. We need to find the good. Sometimes we don't do that enough with parenting altogether, but particularly with teenagers, we don't catch them being good. We don't emphasize the good. Now, again, it's hard to praise a teenager, but you need to do it in an age-appropriate way. You know, thank you for doing that. I appreciate it. That's it. Not like, you're such a wonderful kid, because that doesn't work. Right? You can't be star charts to teenagers. But it needs to be done like a teenager. Like, you know, I really appreciate it. Thank you very much. That was great. And, or if they come and negotiate something with you properly without giving you attitude, you know, later on just say, by the way, you know, that was a great discussion. I appreciate it. That kind of thing. Find ways to accentuate the good. And before we take more questions, I'll just end off with two very important things in a story. First of all, things do go wrong sometimes. We're not perfect. And sometimes we do have a blow-up. And things go off-rail. And things, kids do the things they shouldn't do. And sometimes bad things. Really, really bad things, like doing all kinds of things that they shouldn't do, or getting into company that they shouldn't get into. Even if we've made mistakes, and even if things haven't worked out where we hope they would, we always need to leave that door open. We always need to leave the relationship open. We need to never, ever cut it off. We always need to make it clear that whatever you do, I might not approve, but you're always my child, and I always love you, and always leave that door open to reestablish our relationship. The other thing, I didn't get a chance to talk about it at length, but I want to just mention it very quickly, because and we've talked about the obnoxious, the cheeky, the attitude type of teenager. But there's other things to look for in teenaging as well. Sometimes when kids go through teenaging, all of a sudden there's a lot of very, very hard stuff that they experience. Very, very often when they transition from childhood into adolescence, they start to, some teenagers experience anxiety. Some teenagers go to high school experience depression and things of that nature. That is not, I wouldn't say it's very common, but it's not uncommon. And we need to be on the lookout for signs of these type of things. And when those things are there, we should not be embarrassed to look for help. There's good help available today, and people need to reach out for help. Because sometimes we must never be in denial. You know, as Jewish parents, that's a hard thing to do, but we should never be in denial, because sometimes if we see a problem, a lot of problems can be dealt with early intervention. So it needs to be dealt with right away, and sometimes there's help available, we need to reach out. I'll just end up with a little story and then take some more questions. There's a someone told me a story a while ago. It happened in a little town in America. There was a community, and there was a rabbi coming from Israel, I think, to collect funds, whatever the case is. And this guy went to pick up the rabbi from the airport. And he's picking up the airport, and they're driving through his neighborhoods, and there's a lot of rowdy teenagers all over. So this American guy turns to the Israeli rabbi, and he says, "What do you say? Today's youth is like, you know, just out of control." And to which the rabbi just says one word in his thick Israeli accent. He says, "Frogs." "Frogs?" Like, no, he thought he didn't understand what he was saying. So he repeats the whole thing. "There's youth, there's trouble, there's drinking, there's drugs, there's all kinds of stuff." The rabbi just says, "Frogs." "What do you want about frogs?" And he tries a third time, he says the same thing. The guy says, yes, I heard what you said, but frogs." He says, "What do you mean by frog?" He says, "You know, when frogs have children," he says, "they don't look like them. They're tadpoles, right? And after a while, the frog, who's got green legs and jumps around and has green skin, looks at his tadpoles and says, 'This is mine? This is my progeny? Like, it can't be, you know?' And after a while, the tadpole starts to change form and gets a green skin and grows green legs and becomes a frog just like the parent." So we need to remember that, right? Sometimes we look at our teenagers and it's like tadpoles, like, well, we just need to be the best frog we can, right? And they'll become frogs too in their time. We just need to guide them through that very, very difficult period until they... So before I take questions, just, first of all, thanks for listening. And I just want to also just mention for those that haven't been any of my sessions before, I do one of the passions I have is lecturing in all areas of personal growth, particularly with the Jewish focus. I do a weekly email that has like a little personal growth message every week. Those would like to receive it, if you want to give me your email afterwards, I'd be happy to take it down and put you on the list. Questions? I especially stopped a few minutes early for some questions. Go on. Pop.
Our kids play the blame game. We live in a house with three teenagers.
Daughters.
And we sometimes know which ones committed the act, but we don't blame. So we ask, who left that, or who did that, and can you sort it out? And then you have this finger pointing, and it's always, it wasn't me. So how do you deal with that?
You know, you started the question by saying that you know who it was, right? So, most of the time. Okay. So, if you have a 97% idea, you know, sometimes you need to also humor them a little bit and walk away. Like, what teenagers do best is they engage you in a struggle, and we take the bait, right? So, I'm just to use a simple example. It's something left on the table, for example. You know who left it there. You want to clean it up, right? Very, very quietly, you walk over to the one that you know, left it there, and say, "Just clean it up," and walk away. I didn't leave it. I didn't say anything. Just clean it. And walk away. Normally, there's a good chance that it'll get done because they know it was there. But you refuse to engage in a struggle. If you show any signs of, "Can we have a struggle of this?" They'll go, "Oh yeah, let's have it." Just do it. Like, sometimes short, assertive, very quick instructions are much better. Just like, get it done. If you want them to do it, if it's important to. Yeah?
What about that child that, as much as you try and get that connection? Like, I was driving home from work today and I rang him on the mobile. "Hey, how are you going? What's new? Is nothing? Nah. Work was okay. How was school?" She goes, "I really have to go up with work to do." Like, I get blocked all the time. Just keep doing it.
Great conversation. "No, I really got to go. I got work to do." "Okay, I'm going to say hi. Bye."
"Well, that's what I said."
And they appreciate it. Okay. What they don't appreciate is you say, "No, but I want to talk to you." That's the body language, or even if that's it.
Yeah, so I've got my flu back today, and my arm's really sort of, "Okay, Mom, I've got to go. I've really got to go."
Okay, that's it. Sometimes it's the most, but yeah, every little opportunity counts. It all adds up. It all adds up and it comes back eventually.
Like,
that's what I said. You're investing, you're making what we call emotional, what Stephen Covey calls it, emotional deposits. Yeah. You know, it's like a deposit. It's another deposit. That's it. As long as you don't push, because I hate to be pushed.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But they want it on their terms, and that's what you have to do.
Can I just ask, like, have any of your five children rebelled against, like, your religion or, you know, your tradition?
It's a very good question, and it happens a lot today. Thank God so far not.
Mm-hmm.
I had one that was particularly difficult. And that's when I had to learn a lot of this stuff. and I didn't always do it right, and my wife didn't always do it right, and we had some difficult, challenging moments, but thank God, so far no. Because, as I said, I mean, the values are important, and values, we do expect values from our children, and it doesn't always work. And I tell my mother, who's now visiting here from South Africa, I mean, she has a custom. You know, I will end with this, right? I want to share this with you because I really believe it. It's not just a nice Jewish concept, but I actually honestly really believe it, because I think it's not only good parenting, and I've seen in families where it doesn't always happen, and I'm not finished yet, and I'm still, you know, nervous, but as all parents are. And I've seen parents of very, very good families where it does happen, unfortunately, or it happens not only in religious issues, but other issues as well. And I believe that, it's, you know, we need to do our best, but also we need to really hope that God gives us the assistance. You know, there's a beautiful tradition, and I should share this with you in this context. A couple of traditions. First of all, there's a tradition that when women light candles on Friday night, it's supposed to be a very, very auspicious moment. And when you say the bracha and you put your hands and you cover your eyes, after the bracha, you're supposed to say a prayer, and the prayer is supposed to be specifically about children, about educating children in the right path. And I know when I was a little child, I used to watch my mother, and I could never figure out what's taking her so long. Because I was a good kid, and I saw the siddur, and I knew the bracha. I knew it only takes 5 seconds to say. And she's going on and on and on. And, you know, she has a tradition also besides. Another tradition is that every day she says a chapter of Psalms, a chapter of Tehillim, you know, for each child, for each grandchild, for each son-in-law, for each great-grandchild. I always tell her that it's definitely in the merit of her Tehillim. I'm convinced, right? But I mean that not in jest. I mean that we do actually have to also, we have to pray a little bit. We have to ask God to help us, because parenting is very challenging. And we need to try our best. We also have to get some divine assistance, I think. But particularly that custom of you know, praying by the Shabbat candles, I think is a very powerful thing.
Bringing up a family and being religious, they're both parallels, right? So, yeah, I think the statement is right. It's hinging on what this lady said behind. So, do you often get children who are brought up in very religious families rebelling?
Yeah, absolutely. Really? Absolutely. Because the fundamental of parenting has nothing to do with religious families. I mean, religious practices lend itself, if you do it right, to a lot of good family structure. For example, the Friday night, no mobile phone, right? I mean, there's research, for example, that they did, like, there was once Rabbi Dr. Twersky writes about this. There's research they did about teens at risk and teens of golf and drugs and all kinds of other issues, right? And they try to work out what's the factor. Now, the truth is, you can't work out what's the factor because there'll be millions of things, right? But they found one very, very important factor was mealtimes, family mealtimes. That's incredibly powerful. Because unfortunately, today in families, it doesn't often happen, right? And if it does happen, and mealtimes, by the way, it doesn't mean when the whole family eats the meal in front of the television. That's not a mealtime. Right? That's just people eating at the same time. That's not. Now, for example, you talk about it, I mean, Shabbat, for example, is a great opportunity to do that. But I know families where the Shabbat table doesn't work, because actually you need a strategy to make a Shabbat table work. I mean, the one kid is not interested, the one kid doesn't want to sit there, the one kid wants to leave. You know, so it doesn't come automatically. I mean, the fundamentals of parenting are just in all situations. There needs to be a lot of love at home. There needs to be a good family structure. Stability at home is very, very important. Structure at home is very important. Parenting, younger children, I mean, there's a lot of factors, right? But it's challenging, but we do our best. I just think, again, you know, we shouldn't beat ourselves up. We need to try, and the best thing to know is that when we mess up, we can bounce back. I found that with children, I found it even with teenagers. Teenagers are a little bit more difficult than with younger children, but you could, you know, you can make a clean slate. You can say, yes, honey, I made a mistake last week, but this is the way it is this week. And that's it. And by the way, you can also apologize to children, particularly teenagers. And if you do lose it, and you end up insulting them, you can actually wait and actually apologize and say, listen, I didn't approve what you said, I didn't approve what you did, but I really shouldn't have spoken like that, and I apologize. Yep.
Can I just ask you, in terms of the same question, what would be a good response to a teenager who tells you that their values and their beliefs are not the same as you and your husband or the rest of the family?
Right, right. Really good question.
And are quite adamant about it and quite extreme about it.
Okay, so that's where you come to the whole concept of acceptance. And acceptance is a very, very difficult thing. At the end of the day, and I mean, you know, I've had this with other issues, but in terms of religion, I haven't, as I said before, thank God, but I have seen a lot of families and counsel a lot of families who have. And it doesn't have to be religion, it can be any values, right? This can happen with any values. At the end of the day, you need to let your child know that whatever happens, they are your child, and you will accept them and love them unconditionally, no matter whether they've gone against your values, haven't gone against your values. Now, you might insist, and you might negotiate and say, listen, but while you live here, there are certain things you just have to do, because that's the home structure, and it affects the rest of the house. To give you an example, just to sort of follow on, I spoke to a mother who came to me, and there was a whole issue about a child rebelling against certain religious values that they had, and involved Shabbat, etc. And she used to eat herself up. And as all parents do, religious, not religious, all parents do when children don't follow your values, right? Every parent has values, and when kids rebel, it's very, very, it can really, destroy you. So we came up with a sort of a thing where they all communicate with the child, negotiate that what they do in their bedroom is their business. What they do at the table is different. In other words, this has to be a respect. Because respect has to be the underlying factor of all relationships. And we need to teach them as well. Like, for your good, whatever the child's name is, you're going to go into relationships and you need to learn respect. Everyone's different. So I accept that your values are different, but you have to also have respect for people while you're in this house, right? But you need to know, you need to also know at what age that comes. I mean, if a child of 13 tells you that values are different, you need to be very careful. You must always do something not to lose them. But sometimes you can be a little bit more firm, and you can say, no, but this is the way we do it, and that's it. And you can explain why, and try and explain why. It's more, I think what you're describing is more when they get a bit older, 16, 17, and then they sort of bit beyond your control, really. Then you have to sort of accept it more. Hope for the best, but accept it.
Do you think, that you need to take those consequences and punish, like Shabbat, we say, no screens, no computers, TV. So there's across the road, neighbor who's not Jewish, and my son always says, well, it's okay if I go play there because I'm just watching him play. And it's okay, the rabbis say, it's okay to watch if you don't turn around and play yourself. Do you need to then say you can't go there, or do you take...
I would say that's very, very case specific. I mean, that would be a much larger discussion. It depends on the child, depends on the family structure. Because one thing you need to do with values, and that starts with religious values and other values, all values, is that you don't want them to go up hating your values. As much as, right? Now, we're not in a popularity context, as I said, and rules are rules and structures are structures, but, and values are values. But at the same time, you want to give the most positive experience as you possibly can. You don't want values to be restrictive, even though most values are restrictive. In the world, I mean, most values mean that you can not do certain things because they go against your values, right? But you want to try and spin that around. So you need to know how keen the child is to do it and how not. You need to really navigate that very, very carefully. But we shouldn't be too scared. Sometimes we can put our foot down and we get the sense they're just testing us. And sometimes, especially if they're younger, they're just testing us. Sometimes we can say, no, we don't do that. Mm-hmm. And you do it in a positive way. So something like
that. Yeah, the
shadows
are very boring.
Right, so you need to, so exactly, you sort of turn that around, yeah, and then you find a way of how to make it. That's a whole other discussion, how to make it not boring. But.
Can I ask you a funny question?
Sure.
How can you stop one from meeting the other?
Whenever I give parenting class, I always say sibling rivalry is one of the things I've just never mastered. The most thing is just try and tell them to go somewhere else and do it, and like, it shouldn't eat you up because it doesn't eat them up either. So
walk in the room, just for one walks in with the other.
Well, the worst thing you can do is add in, because you become the third component to the whole compulsion. You're going to deal with it later, but not at the start. Gosh, no, just don't add fuel to the fire.
That's a quick question. It's relevant, but not directly. Say you're at the other end of the spectrum, whereby it wasn't a stable environment, the family, and there wasn't respect on both sides, and you've grown up, and you're now a parent, and you've got a grandparent, you've got kids, or whatever stage you're at. Can you reverse the negativity that had happened, or pretty
sure.
much?
That's a brilliant question.
You stuffed up the teenage years.
No, that's a brilliant, brilliant question. And the answer to you is yes, but. In other words, absolutely. Human beings can always change, human beings can always reverse, and we can always love, but we also have to be honest with ourselves. And people who have grown up in a very rocky teenage situation, or came from broken homes, or disrespectful, or abusive, or from whatever kind of homes they came from, need to recognize that, and sometimes need to get help themselves. In other words, they need to realize they shouldn't just turn around and say, no, I'm fine. I won't repeat the mistakes. And you know that's not true. Because you know when it's not true when you start hearing yourself or hearing you know, your mother, your father, your grandfather, your own mother, in you, right? And that happens a lot, where you say, all the things you said you weren't going to do, suddenly you find them in you. So sometimes you have to do a lot of work, you need to talk to someone, or a mentor, or a coach, or a therapist, whatever, and actually work through those issues. The answer is you can, but it does take a bit of work.
The norm takes your generation to rectify the relationship, say, your parents.
Oh, you mean like the parent with their parent?
Yeah.
And the answer is you can, but it also takes a lot of work. And I mean, there's issues of forgiveness, and there's issues of I mean, yeah.
That's a whole, your way straight.
Not always. Sometimes you can initiate it, and sometimes you can do lots of things that will bring. It doesn't create a way straight, but often in relationships, when you do a certain thing, you facilitate a response, and that works. That's a whole nother. Thank you so much, and you're a great audience. Thank you. Thank you for listening. So there's a paper going around there for those one around. Sorry?